Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 12 of Christian History and Ideas with myself, John Coleman, and Dr. Nirmal Das. Welcome, Dr. Das.
Great to be here, John.
In this recording, we're going to continue looking at Antioch and the various theological battles there. Last episode, we looked in particular at the Judaizers and the role of Antioch in ironing that dissension out. And we left off, and we can kind of pick up here in this episode with a discussion of Gnosticism. And as we boogie along in this recording, we're going to bring things very much up to date. You know, we had mentioned that Antioch, just by the grace of God and the British cartographers, was placed out the borders of Syria and therefore survived. And so Antioch was, you know, in the news in a good way lately. But we're going to find out here that a lot of the tensions that were present in ancient Roman Antioch are, philosophically speaking, the same source of tensions we see in our culture today. So we're going to bring our discussion up into talking about postmodernity, wokeism, and a lot of these topics. With that being said, our viewers do bear with us. We're trying out all sorts of new technologies in these recordings, so we would also invite your feedback on that as soon as show topics. So you may write us at christianhistoryandideas@gmail.com about your reception of the recording quality. But the content is always top notch. And so, Dr. Das, where ought we begin with our discussion of Gnosticism?
Well, let's, like we discussed earlier, let's place it in its context, and let's place it in the city of Antioch. And from there, we can, you know, proceed further into looking at it in particular, and then its relationship to what's going on today.
Excellent, excellent. So we had talked last episode, episode 11, about the role of Platonism and, in its way, an attempt, not altogether disagreeable to later Christianity, of coming up with a harmonious understanding of the universe, but running into conflict with the new faith over realities of sin, of disorder, of death, and so forth, things that Plato doesn't quite, or Platonism doesn't quite account for. If one runs with this idea that the whole universe is inherently orderly, well, what do you do with death and so forth? And this led to a lot of blending. It might be the opposite problem, I suppose, of the Judaizers, who weren't plastic, shall we say, or weren't open to seeing beyond the Mosaic law into the deeper and higher realities of virtue. It's the opposite, where everything is kind of merged with the existing culture, which is a theme that we saw in our discussion of Alexandria as well.
Yes, exactly. And I would add a little footnote to that, is that there's also the problem, two problems: what is the soul and what is evil? And these are the important, I guess, obsessions of the first century and of the later centuries, until it becomes, you know, more codified, for lack of a better term. So what is evil? Why does a good God allow bad things to happen? Notice these are very current questions that are still being asked today. People have, you know, a bad historical memory, so, you know, they can't go back to the older question, sorry, older answers to these very important questions. And these questions emerge from this tension of the Hellenistic world and the Christian mind view, mindset. And through that, very quickly, through that contention of what is the Hellenistic or the pagan world and the Christian world or the Christian mindset, from this contention emerge all kinds of methodologies or explanations of what is what, what's going on. And one of these methodologies or explanations is commonly known as Gnosticism. And here I would caution the listeners to keep in mind that when we are using this term Gnosticism, we're not really talking about one codified set of beliefs that existed. Gnosticism was a huge plethora that covers a lot of different ideas, different approaches, different methods of explanation. But the point is that they're all methods that want to incorporate what Christianity is bringing to the table with what already exists, i.e. Hellenism and paganism. And it's this recipe of the blend that produces what we would call Gnosticism, or I would refer to as various ideas that are trying to understand where Christianity belongs in the history of ideas, because the Hellenistic mind is very, very methodical, and it wants to understand where should we place history in the flow of ideas as we know them from Socrates, well, even the pre-Socratics onwards to our day and age. So they are very orderly, and they want to place Christianity within that order. Remember, this is that harmony thing that you mentioned just now. Where in the harmonious order of things does Christianity belong? And not that they want to reject it, which is the common approach nowadays, which is to say it's irrelevant or not essential. They're not saying that at all. Rather, they're saying this is important, this is what it is, but we need to give it some place in the hierarchy that we've constructed of ideas. Where does it belong? And again, this creates a tension, and this is going to, of course, create what we call Gnosticism, or these various methodologies, and there are so many of them that are going to come into play.
I think with the discussion of Gnosticism, both in ancient Antioch and the ancient world, as well as various echoes that we still hear today, it's almost like a virus in church history that keeps asserting itself. There is that break within Christianity with Platonism in the material aspect, that actual the physicality aspect, where the ancient Gnostics, they would conclude that the God who made matter must be an evil God. And this would clash with the Christians who argued for a redemption of created order. So there's a certain hyper-intellectualization of spiritual concepts that are amputated from the physical that we see in Gnosticism. And that divorce, setting up for our developing discussion in this episode, that divorce between the physical and the intellectual is something perhaps for different reasons that we have in the modern West as well, where people's actual connection to the diurnal cycle, to their own bodily rhythms, and as we find out, even with each other, is warred against on various levels. And this has led to very peculiar philosophical conclusions by people, whether or not they would consider them philosophical. So they are.
Yes. In order to, put what you've said very importantly into its context, let's briefly then summarize what all of these Gnosticisms, all kinds of, you know, of them that were floating around, what were they basically teaching? And all of them, you know, were doing all kinds of different things, but by and large, all of them were saying four things, and you've hit, hit them on the head in your summary. First of all, they were saying always that matter, everything that you see, anything encountered through the senses, is evil. So creation, anything that exists on the earth, is evil, inherently evil. Secondly, the world was not created by God. because God could not create evil, being the perfect good. But it was created by an anti-God, i.e. what the Christians now call the devil. So Satan created the earth. Satan created matter, because that is why it's evil. So the problem for the human beings is, of course, salvation. But what does salvation mean in this structure? Well, for them, salvation is knowledge, hence the word Gnostic in the Greek, gnosos. Salvation comes through understanding and knowledge of a special revelation that will allow us to escape matter and join up with the good God. And that is what he wants us to do. And why does he want us to do that? Well, because he placed a little bit of that goodness in us called the soul, which is trapped in the material and wants to get into evil and wants to somehow escape this, you know, this trap of eternal evil. And here, various concepts of reincarnation and all this sort of thing are going to be around. Notice, by the way, footnote, notice the similarity with Buddhism with Gnosticism, this aspect, especially this aspect of salvation and the evilness of matter. The other thing some of these Gnostics, so-called Gnostics, were saying is that human beings come in three varieties. There's three kinds of human beings, or three classes, we might say. There is the spiritual human being, and this spiritual human being is known by various things that are light infused, i.e. he eats light things like cucumbers and avoid dark things like beets and beans and all that sort of thing. And more esoterically, the spiritual human being does not marry, does not have children, because it's a huge sin to bring other human beings into this cycle of evil. And notice this antinatalism is going to be very prevalent in our age now, et cetera, et cetera. But we'll get into that, where human beings themselves are now evil. So it's a very Gnostic approach. So that's the first kind of human being. The other one is a material human being who cannot be saved, who's just pure evil, not interested in the soul. And when that human dies, the soul is going to be killed off, like it's going to be destroyed. It's not going to be saved. There's no way. And then there's another third category of human beings, which is it's a hazy one. People don't really know how to define it. There's all kinds of approaches. This kind of human being, the third one, is known as the psychic. This has nothing to do with how we understand psychic. Psychic in the sense that the person is aware that he has a soul, but he doesn't know what to do about it. So he could go either way. He could be a materialist and get destroyed completely, or he becomes spiritual and somehow the soul will reconnect to the good God that's beyond us. This reminds me that at this time in the second century, one of the more famous Gnostics or teachers of the Gnostics was a guy named Kuk. Q-U-Q. And his followers were known as Kukites. And the Kukites believed that the Father, who is the good God, united with the Mother of Light, and there were 70 eons of creation before finally humanity was corrupt enough to be created. So when salvation happens, humanity has to go through the 70 forms of the 70 eons in order to reach God, et cetera, et cetera. So these are the Kukites.
Reminds me of the in the Nixon days, the Committee to Reelect the President, CREEP, being the acronym. Unfortunate names for certain groups and people and things.
Exactly, yes, exactly. No, we see these themes reoccurring. These are nothing new. I mean, these are not, something very kooky at all. These are recurring themes. The other ones were the Ophites. These are the odd ones I can remember offhand. The Ophites, who during Eucharist would bring in snakes, because their concept was that, and we still have snake handlers among certain groups of Christians.
Here in America.
Yeah. So the snake handlers. So these were snake handlers, Ovites. And they said the serpent of Eden was not evil because he was bringing knowledge to humanity, and knowledge is what saves us. So anyway, so for them, Eucharist meant the praise of the serpent. And that's what they did. So there were all these oddities in this. But basically, if we remember these four points, we will have hit the major themes in what we call Gnosticism. Matter is evil. The world's not created by God, but by an anti-God. Salvation is knowledge. And there's three kinds of human beings, spiritual, material, and the psychics. And that basically, all these different people, different teachers, like the kooks and all that, they're all moving in these kinds of, in these four areas, trying to define what this is. And this is where the Christians are having a problem with dealing with these characters that are popping up all over the place. But the point is, it's not a rejection of Christianity as such, but it's an effort by the Gentile mind in order to understand and give Christianity its rightful place within the history of ideas. So let's keep that context in mind as well as we move forward. Is that it's not a wholesale rejection, which of course is not the case here today in our day and age, which involves a lot of wholesale rejection. So that's important about the Gnostics. They're not rejecting Christianity. They're trying to give it some kind of room within their own mindset.
And as we transition now to a lot of discussions about truth and so forth, which we see in Antioch, and we'll leave with a quote and a few introductory remarks by myself. Just by way of the history of Antioch, as we transition, I also bring up the point as we're listing heresies that the Nicolaitans that are mentioned in Revelation, well as the Docetists and indeed the Gnostics, all have factions and all have it out with the Orthodox Catholics in Antioch. And if you're interested, a basic 101 reading list once you're through with your Bible is Eusebius's Ecclesiastical History, where he gets into a lot of this early history. And remember, Eusebius had access to sources we don't have around any longer. Sort of stuff is real gold mine for that snapshot of time. So with that,
it's those four summaries I gave of these various belief systems are given by Eusebius, by the way. So it's Eusebius who's given us that. Otherwise, we wouldn't know anything about what these guys were all about.
Yes, he recalls in that book where St. John was in the Roman baths, and he heard that, was it Simon Magus or one of these early characters was nearby, and there are all these early stories. And of course, certain of the Gnostics, at least the Christians, would see in the figures of Simon Magus certain apostolic succession of a sort in those types. And also, I believe Eusebius, before we kick off here to the next part of our talk, Eusebius, I believe, mentions that St. Ignatius of Antioch, he was one of the children whom Christ blessed in the Gospels. Bring the children to me. I believe Eusebius makes that claim in the Ecclesiastical History. Howsomever, I want to kick off here with a quote. We're looking at actually a very similar situation in the West in the 21st century that Rome was in the first, second century, a part of history we've mentioned before where they're coming off of the Romans, by the time Christianity gets on the scene, are coming off of, a century and a half of what we would call skepticism or Epicureanism, they would call it, and so are we now in the 21st century. We've had this long stretch of secularism, and in both cases, I suggest that we certainly see in the historical record, in the first example, that doesn't quite do it for people, and you eventually start seeing new ideas that look a lot like religions begin popping up again. And we see that in Roman history in the third and fourth and fifth centuries. And I suggest we might see it now. And in the description of this recording in BitChute and YouTube, I'll put these articles. Nirmal and I, we grazed off of a couple of things and our own thoughts as well. But here's a good quote, I think, Dr. Das, that we can begin with here. Again, this is very much connected to the Antioch topics. Quote, and this is from an article, that wokeism is the new religion. What makes this an extraordinary moment in history? The article begins. While this war is raging, wokeism is simultaneously being adopted at an astonishing speed by late-stage capitalism. In much the same way as Christianity was absorbed by a declining Roman Empire, it is moving from the fringes into the very heart of power, unquote. So Dr. Das, how, maybe we can define wokeism, and what are some aspects, I certainly have a few off the top of my tongue, what are some aspects of this present milieu that are beginning to take on religious echoes?
Well, let's not forget that when we're talking about any of this stuff, wokeism or wokeness or whatever this is, et cetera, cancel culture, what we're really talking about is, and it's a very old problem, by the way, but I won't get into it now, but what we're really talking about is life supposed to be lived according to a set of ideas or otherwise? And if it's supposed to be lived by a set of ideas, we are immediately in the realm of the Gnostics. And this is what we have to, I think this is what comes to mind right off the bat when I hear things like that quotation you read. So when we're talking about this as a religion, yes, it is a religion because it is asking everyone to live according to certain set of ideas, i.e. once you become woke, you adhere to certain kinds of ideas. And this is what determines your wokeness. And if you reject them, you are not woke, or you are the anti those ideas. So this problem of whether life should conform, or human life should conform generally to ideas as opposed to something else, and we can define that in the Christian context in a different way some other time or later, determines what we talk about when we talk about religion. Now, having read that article and having, you know, looked at it carefully, I also have a problem with this kind of a summary, because these kinds of summaries make very huge assumptions about what religion is all about. So by equating wokeness with what was happening in the Roman world with Christianity, what the writer, of course, unknowingly, unwittingly, or perhaps wittingly is doing, is saying wokeness is like Christianity, i.e. it moved in at the right time when the world was at its weakest and took over. And therefore we have to watch against that sort of thing. So there's an inherent kind of a bias that emerges, and this often happens, whether it's you know, knowingly or unknowingly, I can't say, but it's there in the expression, in the writing, in the sentences. The other thing I have a problem with this sort of approach is that once we start talking about religion in the present context, this immediately has a negative connotation. We've lost this notion of religion as the good, and we've replaced it with somehow superstition, bad, evil, and laughable. We laugh at religion. This is our common understanding. So it's become, unfortunately, a very loaded term. And in order to use it, it draws immediate emotional reactions, which are questionable. So when we say wokeness is a religion, as opposed to a set of ideas, it's meant to evoke certain kinds of reactions. And that kind of rhetorical device I always find rather questionable, because it immediately moves us into that fourth category that we looked at of the Gnostics, which is to divide human beings into certain types. And this is those types doing the certain typical thing that they do. And we have to be very careful with this kind of approach, because that is not the Christian approach, of course. So these kinds of explanations, for lack of a better term, are Gnostic because they follow those ancient patterns that we discussed earlier. So wokeness is a set of ideas. Why? Because the life of the mind is higher than the life of the body. Therefore, the life, the body is not the temple of God. It is something inherently evil and needs to be controlled by laws, by politicians, by regulations, by birth control, by abortion. It needs to be controlled because inherently it is not something that we need more of. So we need less bodies on the planet, and less bodies on the planet equal good things. Notice where all this is going. This is not, you know, something that is inherently good and inherently reasonable from, you know, from the Christian concept of what reason is, because reason is informed by faith. The other thing I have a problem with, and this is, you know, something we can discuss perhaps another time, is this easy assumption of knowing what postmodernism is.
Yes, I wanted to keep your mind about that. I know you've mentioned your hesitancy about that concept.
Yes. First of all, it's bad. Well, it's not philosophy. I don't know what it is. If you study philosophy, you will never encounter postmodernism. However, if you study architecture, you will encounter postmodernism. So a person by the name of Lyotard, the French always do this sort of thing, comes up with this notion of postmodernism, but he never defines it. He just assumes that we've somehow moved beyond what we call modernity. He never defines that either. So when people use postmodernism as somehow a concrete thing that we're now struggling against, and it equals Marxism and communism and all this sort of thing that is, you know, trundled out when you talk about postmodernism, it has no basis in the history of ideas, and definitely not in the in reality of the mind, because by and large we're still struggling with modernity and secularism. Where postmodernism comes in, I have no idea. So I won't, you know, go on and on about it because I don't want to get into a rant mode. But you know, when we're talking about postmodernism, please understand that it's a fake term. It's fake news. There is no such thing. I know books are written. People can Google this to no end. Wikipedia probably has tons of entries in it and all that sort of thing. But read behind what you're reading and you will find that it's nothing there. It is a concept invented in the 1970s with no pure definition. So to use a fake term in order to describe what is actually happening in reality, I think removes us two or three steps even further away from reality into a vague concept of ideas. So, i.e., we have to live by these ideas and we have to react against these kinds of ideas. So when we mention postmodernism, somehow inherently we know it's a bad thing without even knowing what it is. And that kind of manipulation I find very questionable. Why? Because it's basically a fake term invented for fake use, misunderstood by people who even use it all the time. It's like deconstruction. People who use deconstruction misunderstand what it really means. It doesn't mean taking things apart. People use these terms. So we have to be very careful with this one and us. So that's the other thing that threw me off, is that once they start talking about postmodernism and how postmodernism does this or that, is about this or that, suddenly you are simply, I think, sowing confusion among people who may not even know what modernism is as opposed to postmodernism. So my suggestion would be is that we look at the complexity of what is happening, not through reductive terminology. Even wokeness, I find reductive terminology. And we have to look beyond them in order to arrive at a greater understanding of what's going on. Because the problem is, if we don't really understand the problem, we will never be able to come up with any kind of solutions, let alone a dialogue of any kind. Because we'll only be talking in echo chambers, where people assume certain things mean certain things, certain terms, I should say, mean certain things, and therefore, you know, they talk to each other without even discussing. So there's no dialogue as such. And that's always a danger. We have to be very careful with that, because we do not want to cut people off. Rather, we must be, as Christians, inclusive in the dialogue. The dialogue has to be inclusive, both with those that reject us and ridicule us, and those that accept and understand us. I think that is the problem that the early church and the early Christians were having in the Roman world. It was all of that. And it's the same cycle again. So that's my, you know, very quick rant. I'm controlling myself. I'm not going on and on about it. But very quickly, this is, you know, this is my problem with that terminology, postmodernism. It's the same terminology, by the way, that people, I find it in, it's usually said in the same breath as cultural Marxism, another fake term that is invented. You either have Marxism or you don't. There's no in-betweenness. It's like, social Darwinism. You know, these terms have been invented for certain purposes, but those purposes have nothing to do with the ideas themselves that you know, properly should be looked at and discussed and critiqued if they need to be critiqued. But if we slip away from the critique of the original thing, if we talk about cultural Marxism, we're not critiquing Marxism at all, for example. If we talk about postmodernism, we're not critiquing modernism and secularism, which are the serious problems of the day and age. So this is my caveat, my caution to people as they, you know, encounter these terms in unfortunately popular and common culture.
For someone as myself who does think there's such a concept as postmodernism, would a working definition be for modernism that it shares with Christianity and indeed pre-modern other systems, an idea of a meta-narrative, an overall story? So I think we're familiar enough with the Christian, you know, story. Well, that, and I'm just setting this up to ask you to respond against or to certain points in that article. The tone, that's a good point you bring up about the tone of certain words. I didn't think about that. But just to lay it out, you know, we would say that modernity, using this term, would also have a meta-narrative, much like Christianity would have, but it would place it not in a religious story, but in a national story. And that if there is such a thing as postmodernism, that its definition, a working one, would be where there is no overarching story for individuals to plug themselves into. And with that, I think what the article was maybe asserting is that after a long stretch, however long, of this postmodernism, if we'll just allow it for a moment, after a stretch of I'm okay, you're okay, it doesn't matter what you believe, the idea of relativity and so forth, all of a sudden we see, all of a sudden in the past 10 years, we see this assertion of a very doctrinaire and absolute type of secularism of gender, or of something that really has impressed me watching things, is this idea of sin and of excommunication within the secular world, but of course with no understanding of redemption. So I think that is workable, at least in my mind, in certain benefits of that article.
Sure, yes, and I agree with you by and large. The only caveat, again, a caution I would suggest, is that what you describe as post-modernity is actually modernity as well. So we haven't gotten past that notion, because post-modernity supposedly means that we've gone past it and we're not into this hazy, nebulous mode of thinking. We're not. We're still very modernist in our approach. So when you talk about narratives, which is properly narratology or epistemology and so forth, when we talk about narratives or stories that determine how we are and determine reality and so forth, the problem with that is that why I say that is because I'm coming from a concept of modernity. Because to be honest, I still don't understand postmodernity yet, because it was never defined philosophically. And I know what you're saying. I've you know, encountered all these things. But anyway, so in modernity, what we're really talking about when we discuss, you know, these kinds of approaches, especially with the concept of narrative, what we're really looking at is that life must be lived without the question of supernaturalism or spirituality. That's what modernity is, i.e., yeah, way back then people thought people had souls and you had to do something to save it, but we know better. This is it. Life is what we have, and enjoy it, live day, each day to the fullest, except all those terms we've heard. That's what modernity is, and it's a very specific concept that emerges at a very specific time period. You know, I think we've looked at it already. What I would suggest is that your explanations also fall into modernity. So I would have a difficult time saying, oh, that's postmodern, by the way, where narratives are questioned away. Well, that's exactly what modernity did. You know, if you read that, you know, why is, you know, for example, James Joyce, there is his name. Why is James Joyce writing the way he is writing those unreadable two novels he wrote? Why is he doing that? Why is he, you know, shoving that down our throat as good literature? He was a much better poet. He should have stuck to that, actually. Poems penny each are really amazing. But anyway, his novels, those are modernist novels. But they're, by that definition, postmodernist novels. So how can that be when he's destroying narratives fully and completely and with stream of consciousness? You know, we don't have that. So, you know, I won't go on about it. But the point is, very quickly, what I would like to suggest is that when we're looking at the problems of the world today, let's not invent terminology to understand the problems. Let's reuse terminology that was used historically in order to address and meet the same problems. Because what we do is we keep inventing new terminology, we keep falling into that same pattern of thought, which leads to no resolution or no conclusion or even no, happy end. There is no telos here. And that is the hallmark of modernity. No telos. It's a horizontal line which keeps going on forever into infinity. So it doesn't matter what you do. You just keep on doing what you're doing. Live your life to the best you can and be happy, because you're going to die and that's that. The line keeps going. That's modernity. So I don't know where postmodernity intersects and breaks that concept of what life is. My main objection is that why are we inventing new terms in order to address old problems? Because this term, these problems of wokeness and so forth, pulling down statues is nothing new, right? Canceling history is nothing new. This has happened all the time in history, again and again and again. But the cultures, the ideas of that time, of those cultures, address these issues. Let's go back and look at them. So the prime one for us at this time, because we're encountering, is how did the Christians or the church address Gnosticism? Because we're now encountering in all of this stuff, because modernity is a form of Gnosticism, by the way.
Can you hash that idea out, that modernity is a form of Gnosticism?
Very quickly, sure. Very quickly, what does modernity do? It posits the straight line, right? It posits horizontalness of life, of being, as they say. And here we can use Heidegger. I won't get into him, but very quickly, Heidegger's concept of being, where it's a horizontal line that keeps going on into infinity, and therefore it's meaningless. It has no internal, inherent meaning. He very famously, says, why is there something when there could be nothing? That is the purpose and the point of philosophy, to somehow give haphazard answers to something that is inherently incoherent. That is Gnosticism. Why? Because it says that creation never happened. So if a good God created creation, he gave it purpose and life and meaning, and telos. But if you say what modernity says, well, that was all superstition, that's fine. We ended that with the Middle Ages. Notice the Middle Ages are associated with superstition. So once we got rid of the superstition, we brought in science, we brought in reason. And science and reason cannot prove purpose and meaning into life. It cannot. There's no way. And therefore, because that cannot happen, life is what it is. It keeps going on forever, and so forth. And it's inherently meaningless. This is, you know, Sartre. This is, existentialism. All of this sort of thing that comes out. It's modernity. It's modernism in literature, in movies, in culture, and so forth. Philosophy. It's all of that sort of thing. It's what in philosophy is known as post-structuralism, where structures are now questioned away, and in their place, all you have is the question. You can only have questions. You cannot have answers.
That's almost like Act 17. It reminds me of Act 17.
I'm sorry?
It almost reminds me of Act 17. The people always ask questions, never hearing answers, that sort of thing.
That's it. So that's my, you know, very quickly, I could go on, but that's basically what modernity is. It's this inability to answer questions because we cannot, because there is no meaning or purpose. Purpose and meaning are only haphazard conditions that we establish for ourselves in order to make ourselves happy and live out what we have to do. It's a very bleak approach to life.
I'd like to close up on this memorial of St. Pius X, very much a figure who grappled with modernity, dying as World War I was breaking out. But I'd like to conclude with that. If I could pick your mind for a second, in the article, did you find any interest in the point they made about the influence of the hypertext on people's thinking? As regards relativism in particular.
Yes, and you've hit it, and that was a very, I'm glad you pointed that out. I was going to mention it. I made a note of it, but I forgot. I'm glad you mentioned it. The concept of the hyperlink or technology, the techne in Greek, is a very fundamental concept of modernity, by the way. And modernity is technology. Technology is modernity. That concept is very, very fundamental. So again, I don't know how we are postmodern. We haven't gotten past technology. But anyway, I won't have you belabor that point. Very quickly, when the article talks about the hypertext, i.e., taking you into rabbit holes, for lack of a better term, you keep clicking and going somewhere else, and you click there and you go somewhere else. What that suggests, of course, is a very modernist, secularist approach to life, i.e. amusement. There is no inherent purpose for you to read the article. It is only play. That is what this is. You are playing, for lack of a better term, you're killing time. Sure, you may learn, but what's the point of learning? This is how bleak this gets, and this gets bleaker with Heidegger, of course. He keeps going with this sort of thing, and that's modernity, that's modernism. When this concept of hypertext comes in, it's a very crucial one because it's something very prevalent in our day and age, the day and age of the screen, where everything is hyperlinked to something else, i.e., reality is elusive. And therefore, it's unobtainable. All you can do is glide from one virtual reality to another, from one screen to another, to another, to another, until it's dinner time or lunch time, or you're hungry or you're tired,
or you're 80 years old and you've wasted your whole life
clicking at things. Exactly, and it's a very Gnostic approach to life, by the way. Why? Because inherently, matter or life is evil, or as they define evil now, meaningless. It has no purpose. It has no meaning. So why should education now be free? Because inherently, education is meaningless. It doesn't really do anything because it's disconnected from any kind of concept of reality, right? Mm. And you know, therefore you can go to college or university forever and the government will pay for it.
That's the only thing people
care about. Or get some kind of esoteric job, you know, whatever that is. And yeah, there is no inherent purpose or meaning in any of this stuff. The concept of wisdom has disappeared because modernity is very anti-wisdom. It's all for knowledge. It doesn't need wisdom. Christianity, as not being and being anti-Gnostic, is all about wisdom. You know, wisdom is at the very beginning of creation, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we won't get into that. But the concept of wisdom or holy wisdom is something that is entirely missing in this construct. So modernity is not about wisdom. Modernity is about information or knowledge, as they call it. The knowledge-based economy, as they call it, right? So knowledge creates, spins money, which then spins meaning. If you break away from that chain, you are meaningless. Commit suicide, watch porn, do this, do that, whatever. You know, that's what you do. So this is why I find Gnosticism, and this is the problem that the early church fathers had with Gnosticism, is that it was bleak with no end to it. You know, life without purpose, meaning that humanity has no purpose on this earth. And this is going to be Schopenhauer and all these characters who are antinatalists, i.e. anti-humans. And this is why in the environmental movement, in the fringe extreme left, you do have people saying, let's get rid of humanity from the earth, and it'll be good for the planet. And we have versions of it in politics, i.e. birth control, less people. So we don't use up the resources, the Malthusian approach. All of these are the modernity's hallmarks of modernity and bleakness. So hypertexting things is an expression of modernity, is an expression of of what this whiling away of time is all about. You while away the time because you don't know what else to do. It's Sartre, you know. You're falling into a bottomless pit, you might as well be happy. That's modernity in a nutshell, if I were to summarize it in a sentence.
And what a contrast that is, circling back to Antioch. I think of St. Ignatius, his lesson for the breviary for October 17th that day, where he is at least putting a strong face forward. I don't know if he's actually excited, but he's certainly putting an optimistic appraisal on his coming death as he speaks about being ground as wheat by the teeth of the lions. There's a real juxtaposition with these Gnostic sentiments, whether ancient or modern.
Exactly, and these Gnostic sentiments are countered by the concept of Christian virtue, the three virtues, that St. Paul talks about, faith, hope, and charity. Virtues are what defeat modernity and what will defeat Gnosticism, and did defeat historically Gnosticism. So my point in all of this sort of thing is not, why don't we talk about faith, hope, and charity instead of talking about, you know, cultural Marxism or postmodernism and all these meaningless terms. Let's talk about terms that are really meaningful to people, like hope, you know, like charity, like faith. These things have purpose and meaning and give a specific direction to humanity. And not only that, by doing that or by giving that kind of direction, what you end up with is the creation of civilization, which is what we're lamenting, all of us in our own way, the destruction of, you know, the destruction of civilization. So even the cancel culture is trying to build a civilization, whatever that is that they have in their minds, by knocking off, you know, statues or kicking out racists and Nazis from this and that place. They're trying to build a better world or a civilization, but because they're Gnostic, it's a horizontal line. There is no end. There is no telos. There is no civilization at the end of this. It's only whiling away your time while you're here, trying to be relevant, trying to be meaningful in a meaningless world. This is what the bleakness that we're encountering. And unfortunately, these terms or this kind of approach leads us away from a solution into further bleakness, into further hopelessness. So my suggestion is that instead of using these vague terms, let's use the real terms that actually matter to people. And let's, you know, include courage into that. Let's include strength, valor into hope and charity and faith, because then we're getting somewhere, because then we're actually talking about adding to the world as opposed to adding to the evil of the world, which is what ends up happening when we believe that life is horizontal and not vertical. That is the key, that we do have a higher purpose and meaning. And if we reject that, we end up, I think, in the bleakness, which is often referred to as nihilism. And that is not a good place to be for any human being. And so that's my suggestion, is that let's look at the old terminology that worked. And by that, I mean the terminology of virtue, which is very, very important in this discussion, especially in this day and age.
Yes, and you know, it worked. It worked in Antioch in that situation, in that milieu, and it works today. And so we see, coming back to our original topic, and then making a nod as we close up here on this episode 12 of Christian History and Ideas, we see the same type of malady. And the same type of solution, and that's the purpose of the church, is to offer that medicine.
Exactly, and the church has to be not careful not to fall into the trap of using this terminology in order to arrive at their own kind of solutions, because that often happens, is once the church can get misled by this sort of thing as well. And here's the challenge for the church in the here and now, is that all too often, unfortunately, this kind of terminology is being accepted and used. And I think you cannot control the end once you use the bad approaches. You can't control where this is going to go. And this is, I think, the problem the church, modern day church, is starting to face, is that they've incorporated this various terminology into its theology. And it's leading to all kinds of weird places where they don't know what to do. And it's leading to all kinds of contradictions and tensions, which are unresolvable, I think, in my mind, if those words continue to be used. So I guess the big lesson here, the greater wisdom, is that words have consequences. And we better be careful how we use them.
Indeed. But I think our words for this recording are, I've run their course here. We'll have to send Rome a few copies of Ignatius and Paul of Samosata and a few of those guys and get them back on track there. Our audience members, please again be advised, we're trying out all sorts of technologies and recording new devices, so we welcome your consideration on the quality of that, as particularly the audio and also the visuals and so forth. So this is all new to us. Thank you for bearing with us. We welcome, in addition to that, in the comments and on the website platforms and to christianhistoryandideas@gmail.com, show suggestions and insights besides. Dr. Doss, what type of topics might you be looking for, if anyone has a writing finger on them or writing hand, for September, October? Any topics you want to throw out there for interested writers?
Sure, yes. We have a very interesting interview coming up in the September issue of The Postle, interview with Dr. Walter Block. He's one of the foremost philosophers of the U.S., a libertarian philosopher. And so he has recently gotten into trouble through the cancel culture and he's at Loyola I think New Orleans, I think so. Anyway, he's in trouble with the cancel culture because he said certain things about slavery that people don't agree with, very interesting things actually, where he said slavery can be voluntary, Very interesting discussion. So there's an interview with him, and I think people will enjoy listening to what he has to say, especially in the light of a petition that's going around to have him removed from basically fired from the university, and a counter petition that says increase his pay, give him more money or something, because he's great. So that's a very interesting one that people might want to look at.
Excellent. And if anyone's interested in my work here in NUMA for Connecticut, we teach on an undergraduate level, but even, sharp 15, 16 year olds can get along pretty well. And here at Apakistastasis, an institute for the humanities, my only announcement would be to get on the newsletter. And you may do that by writing apakistastasisinstitute@aol.com. We have a whole series about the dangers of do-it-yourself education. I think we've talked, us in the ed world, I think we've criticized till we're blue in the face the mainstream, and that's great, but there's a whole lot of problems in the offing in the homeschool world and in do-it-yourself college or whatever, of which I'm very much part of that world. So that is the theme for the year's worth of newsletters coming up. So do get on that. Dr. Dawson, thank you so much for your time, and we look forward